This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. On New Year's Eve 2009, Vermont native and professional snowboarder Kevin Pierce was training for the upcoming Winter Olympics. He and some friends were trying out the 22-foot-high halfpipe in Park City, Utah. Trying to pull off a move called a cab double cork, Pierce hit his face on the descent just above the left eye. The injury was catastrophic. Pierce was in a coma for a week, critical care for a month, and rehab in Denver for more than 3 months before he came home to Vermont to continue his recovery. Even several years later, recalling the accident was difficult for the Pierce family.
We flew through the night. We got into Salt Lake. I remember driving through the street to the hospital, and it was New Year's Eve.
Walking into his room. You could just tell from, he didn't look like Kevin. He had 30 tubes in him, and he looked like he was dead.
Just seeing him there, lying there, was by far the worst thing that's ever happened, I've ever seen. It was just numbing. It was just that, that boy who could do anything.
And the nurse said, it's really okay to touch him. And I was really lucky that she said that, because I wouldn't have known if that was okay or not to touch him.
That audio of Kevin's dad, brother Adam, and mother is from the 2013 documentary The Crash Reel from HBO Films. It chronicles Kevin's accident and recovery and how the family dealt with both. But a lot has happened in the 6 years since Pierce's injury. From needing to relearn basic skills like walking and brushing his teeth and hand-eye coordination, Kevin Pierce is now snowboarding again, although not competitively. He's much in demand as a public speaker, and he and his brother Adam co-founded an organization dedicated to helping other people with traumatic brain injuries. It's called the Love Your Brain Foundation. We're joined today by both Kevin and Adam Pierce. Kevin and Adam, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having us. We're so psyched to be here.
Yes, this is so exciting. Thank you so much.
Kevin, do you remember anything from the accident?
I don't. It's so wild to go back and think about that, because I don't remember the previous day, that morning, or the following month and a half of that month and a half. And it's so wild just because it was New Year's, and New Year's is thought of, it's for a new beginning and a new start. It's just kind of everything. And it's like my new start was so incredible to go back to that day and think about, the new start for me.
What do you first remember then? If, for a month and a half, you don't have memory, what do you start to see in your mind when you think back to the time that you do start remembering?
Well, the real first memory was when they took me in an airplane from the University of Utah to the rehab hospital in Colorado. But then there's another huge gap of memory after I got to that hospital where I really don't have much memory of the next 3 to 4 weeks. So I just remember that plane because it was so loud and the flight attendant was really not nice to me at all. And it was kind of a weird experience. I thought I'd be on like a really nice little jet, and they had me on this like loud old propeller plane, and it was pretty awful memory.
Adam, in the clip that we played from the crash reel, it clearly made you very emotional to recall what getting the initial news felt like and those first few days with Kevin in a coma. Is it still difficult for you remembering that time?
Yeah, there's always emotion that's brought up, especially just from the work we do and hearing the stories and having people share what they're going through, and it just brings us back to that exact moment. So, 2.5 million brain injuries happen each year. Something like every 13 seconds a brain injury happens. So I think I'm reminded of it quite a bit. Even hearing that voiceover was emotional. But I think there's been so much positive that's come from that experience that it really helps with that.
At that time, in 2009, you were both very good and very competitive snowboarders. Was the sport getting too difficult or too dangerous because of all the tricks that were being done and how high the half pipes were being built then, Adam, do you think?
I personally don't think so. I think it was a time where all the riders were trying to figure it out. Kevin was doing everything in his control to make it as safe as possible. As you see in the film, he brought the airbag. They were all wearing helmets. They were really trying to take calculated risks at what they were doing. And I think that's just the nature of any new sport, you know, when things are progressing and things are new. And that's a lot of fun of it for riders and people involved, is to see that progression happen. So we get this question a lot, and I just don't think I don't think it's too dangerous, and I think it's safer when you definitely have the infrastructure in place.
That airbag you mentioned is an airbag that was at the end of the half pipe so that you could practice tricks and not have to land them actually on the snow, on the really hard-packed snow. Kevin, in the film The Crash Reel, your dad, though, says he thinks that it was sort of there was one thing building on the next. People had to do better and bigger and higher tricks all the time, and that perhaps it was getting too dangerous. Adam says, no, that's the nature of the sport. What do you think, Kevin?
I totally agree with Adam. I snowboarded because of the freedom and because I was able to go out there and do whatever I wanted, and there was nobody telling me how I could do anything. There were no coaches telling me what I had to do. It was all me and my friends and Adam out there learning what we wanted, and that is what drew me to it and ultimately why I loved it so much. And I believe I got so good at it is because of the self-expression and all the freedom there was in it.
We're talking today with Kevin and Adam Pierce about snowboarding, traumatic brain injury, and recovery. And we're also going to be talking about their Love Your Brain Foundation. If you have a question for them, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. You're already getting some listener love. Kevin in Brookfield says, Kevin and his family are such great people. Kevin, I am proud to say I know you. Love you, brother. I ride and ski for Kevin, as do my boys. And Joe Healy, author of Traumatic Brain Injury Handbook, says, congratulations on featuring Kevin Pierce in Love Your Brain. He's a champion for TBI-related causes and certainly a gold medalist when it comes to raising awareness for TBI. Kevin, your recovery was really grueling. You had to relearn basic functions, and the frustration you felt in not being able to do things was really palpable. How difficult was it for you to accept that you had a life-altering injury?
Well, I think for me, the hardest part was not knowing and having no awareness of what this injury was and ultimately what it was going to do to me and how it was going to impact my life. And it wasn't for 2 years till I really could come to the place and listen to my family, as they were trying to tell me the whole time. I was not willing to listen, and my brain wasn't willing to tell me how bad I had injured it and how severe it was and how much it was going to change my life. So I didn't really know, and it was so hard not knowing, and then it was so hard finding out and realizing that I wasn't going to be able to get back to competitive snowboarding, that I wasn't going to be able to live that life that I'd worked so hard for, and yet it had been completely flipped upside down and pretty much lost all of that.
What was your brain telling you when your family would say, no, you can't do this again, or at least not right now? What was your brain saying?
It was saying they're all wrong. They have no idea what they're talking about. You're fine. I felt fine. Watching the crash reel, I obviously didn't seem fine. I'm not fine, but to me, I was fine, and there were no issues. I didn't have any broken bones. Felt like I could do anything and everything. I was so good at snowboarding, and why won't they just let me get back out there and do what I'm so great at? What do they know?
Adam, how did you and your family deal with that?
It was a really challenging time, and I think it was a lot about communication and trust. And I think, as you see from the crash reel, there was a lot of family dinners where we would sit around and really just be honest with each other and express kind of our concerns and fears. And I think Kevin had an amazing ability to listen, and a lot of people question how we could have let him get back on a board. But when you look at that, he took 2 years off and really listened to us. And although we had arguments, they were all very healthy, and everyone expressed their concern. And we all kind of agreed and landed on a place that said, okay, in 2 years, let's set up a safe environment where he can get back and do something he really loved. And something that was beautiful about that is it really helped Kevin in his recovery process, because he was driven to get back out there, and we could show him areas that he needed to improve, and he would work on those. And incredibly determined as he was, he proved a lot of us wrong and got to a place that we all felt pretty comfortable with him doing that.
How did you deal with that, though? I mean, for people who haven't interacted with somebody who has a traumatic brain injury very much, or haven't dealt with that in their family, you know, one of the things that is so difficult is that somebody's brain is injured and it may be telling them something different from what you and the rest of the family and the rest of the people around this person are experiencing about their abilities and about what they think they can do versus what you think they can do. You know, your brother was an adult and he's your brother, and here you are having to tell him, I don't think you can do what you think you can do. That must have been really difficult.
Yeah, it was incredibly, incredibly challenging. And especially on top of it, you know, I wanted to see him succeed. I wanted to see him happy. And to tell him no to so many things was just incredibly sad and difficult. But I think there was some level of belief that we all had that if, you know, if we could, you know, give him enough time that we would see some incredible things. And luckily that's happened.
Again, we're talking with Kevin and Adam Pearson. If you have a question, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note from Natalie who says, having sustained a traumatic brain injury myself in 2010, I have been continually shocked and amazed by how little understanding and support there is from the medical profession. We are pretty much left on our own to figure out how to live in this new mind and body, which doesn't function the way we expect it to. At first, I thought it might be rural Vermont, but I've gone all the way to Stanford University and found the same lack of help. There are many helpful treatments out there that doctors seem unaware of. Kevin, is that your experience? You seem to have a lot of trust in your doctors.
Yeah, I do have a ton of trust in my doctors, and yet I experience the same things. And that is why that's such a perfect transition into where we are now and what Adam and I are doing now. And that has been the Love Your Brain Foundation. And being able – that is one of our main goals. And the number one thing we want to do is create this community that helps like – people like myself and like all of us that are going through this that don't have that and that don't have that support and don't have that knowledge of what they do after they get out of the hospital. There's so much help in the critical care and that first month and those first stages, and then you're pretty much just left on your own to figure it out. And there's so much unknown what to figure out. There's so much unknown about the brain. And so if we can be there to help those people and to help them get through those stages like that I've been trying to get through it, it feels like it will really make all of this something that is so much more than just okay, and this injury will become something that I can really be so proud of having to go through. And whereas I was so proud of my snowboarding, and obviously I didn't sign up for this, but I can make this even more powerful and more amazing than my snowboarding was.
Do you feel that yet? Or are you still waiting for that feeling that this is as powerful?
It's a hard one. You know, I'd be lying to you if I was to tell you I totally feel it and that I feel what I got from snowboarding through this. But I believe as it's shaping up and we're doing so much more and affecting so many more people that it is kind of becoming that way, and I am starting to feel that.
Adam, you and Kevin founded the Love Your Brain Foundation in 2014 together. Can you tell me what the goal of the foundation is?
Yeah, as Kevin said, it's all about building community for people who have been affected by brain injury. You know, it's so common that people become isolated and depressed and change. And when the close people around you can't deal with that and your friends don't know how to understand you, it's such an invisible injury. And all of those people tend to leave. It can be just very, very debilitating. And what we're really excited to do is develop these programs where we can bring people together. Our focus is on developing a yoga and meditation program. And it's all about bringing like-minded people into the same space and allowing them to share things that they've gone through and new healing techniques, and also provide them tools to take their recovery into their own hands and move forward.
Why was that so important for you? I mean, clearly it's been really critical for you and for your whole family to work with Kevin to make sure that his recovery, you know, was as good as it possibly can be. But why did you feel such a powerful urge or need to reach out to others who are in similar situations?
Well, I think the main theme and the main takeaway people get from the crash reel is the importance of family. And we were so fortunate to have such a strong family and friends and people within our community reaching out to support. And through the creation of the crash reel, We've gotten so many responses and heard so many stories where people don't have that same support, and it makes such a big difference. And for us, that was the most important thing that we thought we could really help and try to make better for so many people.
Let's go to one of our calls. Mark is calling in from Burke. Hi, Mark. You're on the air. Go right ahead. Oh, we'll see if we can get Mark on the air in just a moment. We're talking with Kevin and Adam Pearson. If you'd like to weigh in, ask them a question, share what you remember, what your experiences are with TBI yourself, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Kevin, Adam just mentioned that yoga and meditation is one of the key pieces of what you're doing with the Love Your Brain Foundation, and you run yoga teacher training, you run classes. Why is yoga for TBI sufferers such an important part of the picture?
I had the most amazing experience with yoga, and it's so wild what happened to me. I was out in California where I used to live, and I drove up to a yoga class. I'd wore glasses for 3 years after my accident, and I got a crazy eye surgery and still had to wear glasses after that. And then I went up to this yoga class, and I took the class, and I came out of it, and after taking a shower, I no longer needed to wear my glasses, and I haven't worn them since that yoga class that day. So that has just kind of – I've fallen in love with yoga more than anyone could ever know, except those people. So many people love yoga, but it's been so incredibly healing for my brain and helping me to slow down and to not rush my healing.
Those glasses became such an iconic part of your look post-injury, Kevin. It must be different not to wear them.
Oh, it feels so good. I hate glasses so much.
We're talking today with Kevin and Adam Pearce. When we come back, we're going to learn more about what they do with the Love Your Brain Foundation and talk about where they are now, how their family has come together through this process, 6 years of recovery for Kevin Pearce from that really devastating snowboarding accident that so many people saw and learned about. If you have a question for them, call 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're talking with brothers Kevin and Adam Pearce today. Together, they founded the Love Your Brain Foundation after Kevin suffered a severe traumatic brain injury while snowboarding on the last day of 2009. If you have a question for the Pearces, call 1-800-639-2211 or post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. In The Crash Reel, the HBO Films documentary made about the Pearce family and about Kevin's recovery, Kevin Pearce's friends candidly explain that he's different after the accident.
Is Kevin the same? He's not. He's not the Kevin before his accident.
Yeah, Kevin.
Oh! Kevin freaking hit his head, and no matter how many years go by, it's like, I want to shake him. Kevin, wake up. You know, it's like.
What the hell?
It's definitely embarrassing for us sometimes to be out in public with Kevin. No offense, Kevin, but sometimes he'll just say something inappropriate, coming off as mean, like too upfront and blunt about things. He was definitely the older brother. He was definitely my older brother and my mentor, and now it's the other way around.
That film came out in 2013. Today, it's been 6 years since the accident, and Kevin is still recovering. The plasticity of the brain and the idea that recovery is an ongoing process is something they stress at Love Your Brain, the foundation that they together formed in 2014. That's Adam and Kevin Pearce. And together, they are with us today on Vermont Edition. And if you would like to share your thoughts, please post on our Facebook page. Go to Facebook, find Vermont Edition, or write to vermontedition@vpr.net. Kyle says, I just want to throw a big thank you out. You have continually inspired me to get out and snowboard throughout any issues I may have had. Although I did not suffer a traumatic brain injury, I have continually looked up to you and your accomplishments since getting back on a board. Thank you again, and keep shredding. So again, post your notes on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. The crash, realize I said, came out in 2013. So, Kevin, your friends were reflecting on your recovery about 3 years into it. How do you think you are now in terms of impulse control or saying things that other people might find inappropriate?
It's getting better. It's always getting better. My brain is always continuing to heal, and I believe it will forever. The doctors like to say that the healing happens in the first year, and that's kind of like when it's going to happen. And it was so crazy to hear that and to be like, I only have a year to do this, and now to see how much my brain is still continuing to heal 6 years later. And it gets old and it gets tiring, and there are times where you're just like, why? And then at the same time, it's so exciting and it's so cool that I can still continue to heal and get better. And what else heals 6 years later? Your leg's not going to keep healing 6 years after you break it, and your brain does. It really does continue to heal as long, and that comes along with as long as you do the right things for your brain, as long as you continue to love your brain. And to talk a little bit about that, what I mean by when I say continuing to love your brain is how I like to say it is to care and to stop and to do. And what I mean by that is to care for your brain, because our brains are the most important things we have. So to stop doing all those things that are so bad for your brain. They like to say sugar is like poison, and that just kills me because I have the worst sweet tooth ever. So when my mom told me I couldn't eat candy bars, I just got so mad. But to do all the things that are so good, to go out there and do yoga, to go out there and move, to exercise, to eat the healthy foods, and to learn that and to get to that place where I truly do love my brain continues to heal it in the most amazing ways.
You just said it's really frustrating, though, when you know the things that your brain isn't able to do. Are you able to sense things that you can or can't do, or when you feel like your brain is actually healing and growing stronger?
That's a hard one, because in ways, yes, but in so many ways, no. Our brains don't give us the information that we need, whereas when we break an arm, we know our arm's broken. It's very clear. Our brain tells us, you know, this hurts. It's broken. Like, you can't do anything with this arm until it heals. And when your brain breaks, it doesn't like to give you that information that it's broken. And why that is, I have no idea, but it doesn't always tell you the things you need to know.
So do you rely on feedback from your friends and from your family?
Yeah, and I'm much, much better at relying on that feedback now compared to how when I used to think I knew everything, and that what were they saying? What did they know? Why would I listen to them? They were telling me everything I didn't want to hear. So now I'm able to see, like, they just love me and care for me, so I need to do what they tell me.
Adam, when Kevin was still in the hospital, a friend told your father to prepare himself for not having the same Kevin after the injury as the Kevin he knew before. And he didn't mean just physically. How different do you think Kevin is now?
There's some minor changes, I think, that we pick up on. But I think overall, as Kevin just said, you know, it's night and day from where he was even 3 years ago. And it really is, because he's been so resilient and determined to get back. Not necessarily get back to where he was, but to get back to a place where he feels happy and can live a fulfilled life. So, you know, there's some minor memory changes, and his eyes aren't as good, which can lead to some balance things. But I think overall, continuously to see just amazing improvements.
We got a note from Martha in Essex who says, when Kevin thought he was able to do things that his family didn't think he could do, was that actually his brain damage that caused the disconnect, or was it denial? What do you guys think?
It's a great question. You know, I think there's probably a little bit of a mix in both. I think there can be denial, and I think obviously the brain injury has a part to do with it as well. So I don't have a clear answer for that.
Adam, this changed everyone's life, but it really changed the trajectory of your life and your career as well. You left your job to help care for Kevin while he was in rehab, and now you're executive director of this foundation that the two of you created together. When you think about this past 6 years and the sort of path that you're on, where do you think you're going, and how different is it from what you had imagined?
It's completely different. I never would have ever known that I would be doing this work, but I feel incredibly grateful for it. I feel like I've never been so passionate and into a project in my life. And we have an amazing team supporting us, and we're really encouraged by the progress of the programs that we're developing and the community that we're building. So I'm incredibly grateful. I'm excited because I think we're just starting, and I think we've already been able to touch so many lives, and it's just going to continue to grow and evolve and really make some meaningful impacts.
We got a note from Barbara, who's a certified brain injury specialist trainer in Waterbury, and she says, the Love Your Brain program is wonderful. Support groups can be really important for people who are feeling isolated and misunderstood. And Kevin, that isolation and depression are big parts of traumatic brain injuries. How important has it been for you to have people to connect to who have also experienced some of the same things that you have?
Well, it's wild because all brain injuries are so different. No matter where it is, no brain injury will ever be the same. Yet so many majority of brain injuries are so similar, where we're all dealing with so many similar issues. You know, memory, which I deal with, which so many other people I've talked to do, balance, whatever it might be, all these different, getting irritable, getting angry, so many issues that come up. And to be able to sit down and talk to people that get it, you know, I've always said since day one, no one will ever understand this unless if they go through it. I have, as you see in the crash reel, the most amazing mom that one could ever imagine. And if anybody gets it, mom gets it. But then at the same time, it's like she'll never get it in the sense that she hasn't had one, which I'm so thankful for. But it's just tough because getting to sit with those people and talk with those people and work with those people that do get it is really so helpful.
We're talking with Kevin and Adam Pierce today about traumatic brain injury and the foundation they started, Love Your Brain. You know, it's interesting. You mentioned your mother, and she is featured in this documentary, The Crash Reel. Adam Pierce, you were instrumental in making the documentary, and your family is a really huge part of it, your other brothers and your dad and your mom. This is sort of an aside, but I was struck by how much filming your family and you and your friends all did, you know, sort of independent of this film that was created about you before the accident. Even when you guys were children, there were home movies and family movies. And then in recovery and rehab and early on after Kevin's accident, there were still a lot of family movies that you guys were making. Was that just something your family always did?
Yeah, there always seemed to be a camera around, especially when Kevin started you know, getting really good at snowboarding. There always seemed to be people filming, and Kevin and I were always filming. And yeah, we were pretty fortunate. We had like 200 people submit footage for the editing process of the crash reel, and that was about 17 terabytes of footage. So it was a large amount of content.
We got a question from Mark in Burke, who says, would a family of lesser or modest financial means have been able to get the same level of medical treatment that Kevin got?
It's a great question. You know, I think every state varies in terms of what you have for access. So I think a lot of it depends where you are. But absolutely there's, you know, financial comes into play. If you have good health insurance, it definitely makes a difference. And especially for kind of the length of time you can have as an inpatient, in the rehabilitation process.
We got a note from Terry in Stowe who says, it's great to hear both Kevin and Adam sharing their story. My understanding is that one of their other siblings was born with a developmental disability. Do the brothers feel like their experience growing up with someone with a disability helped them cope when Kevin was injured? Kevin, what do you think?
I think I love that question. There's nothing I love more than getting to talk about my brother David, who has Down syndrome. And in the movie, we talk about how David has Up syndrome because he's an up kind of kid. He has brought more light and love to my life than anybody else. And what he has done to allow me to grow and get through this brain injury is the biggest blessing. And growing up with David has been such an eye-opening, life-changing experience for me. And I can never begin to say enough good things about David.
You know, in the documentary, The Crash Reel, David also says, though, that he sometimes, while he says, I think of it as Up syndrome sometimes, that he also sometimes feels really down about it and depressed, and he goes into his room and cries a little bit, and then he comes back and, you know, interacts with family and friends again. And towards the end of the film, as Kevin, you're sort of coming to the realization that your life is changed and your career is changed by your accident. Your family asks David, does this change your ability to accept and feel more positively about your Down syndrome? Has that happened?
Yeah, that's actually my favorite part of the crash reel, without a doubt. When Dave goes, sometimes I get depressed, I go up into my room, I cry, I get sad, and I wake up and it's a new day. And that's a perfect example of Dave. He's able to move past these issues, and he's been able to work through his Down syndrome, and he hasn't driven in his entire life. He has his first girlfriend in 30 years, and yet he's one of the happiest kids in the world. And so having him there and his kind of mentality and his guidance and his path and just kind of how he has done all of his things has been so healing and helpful for me.
Before we leave our conversation today, you've mentioned, Kevin, that you do snowboard again, and not competitively, but it's a part of your life. And Adam mentioned, you know, how difficult this was for the family initially to think about you getting back on a board. How do you balance the risk, which is there, with your desire to live the way you want, which clearly has always involved some sort of adrenaline and a sense of adventure? How do you think about how you balance that?
Well, number one, I think it's not putting my brain at the risk of being injured. My brain doesn't have the ability to be hit again. Having it happen once that bad is all it can take, and being able to it's an example of how it can heal after it does happen once. But as you'll see in the crash reel, there's Trevor who has done it twice, and it's just a totally different story after it happens again. So I get out there, but I don't put myself at the risk and in the place of putting myself at the ability to have that happen again.
Adam, as we let you two go, you brought in an item that is very special to your family, and I'm hoping maybe you can just very quickly describe it and then share with us your family tradition.
Yes. So I brought in a Tibetan singing bell that we use before every dinner. Its significance is really to bring people into the present moment and really just let go of everything else around you and just focusing on the sound of the bell. So we can end this with the sound of the bell, and hopefully everyone takes a moment to just be present today.
Kevin Pierce, Adam Pierce, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us on.
And we have links to the Love Your Brain Foundation at vpr.net. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. And now it's time for Dorothy's List, our series about the books nominated for Vermont's Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Book Award. Each month during the school year, we visit with middle grade students reading one of the books nominated for the award. This month, we examine a personal story told in words and pictures by Cece Bell in the book El Defo. VPR's Amy Noyes takes us to Richmond Elementary, where a group of fourth graders have been discussing this graphic memoir.
It's really fun.
Graphic novels are really popular among fourth graders, but El Defo is the first graphic memoir that many of these Richmond Elementary students have read. Cece Bell's life story unfolds across the pages in comic book style panels. We first meet Cece as an energetic preschooler who loves to wear her polka dotted bathing suit everywhere. Then we watch her get sick and lose her hearing as speech bubbles fade to blank. Belle was 4 years old when she became deaf. El Defo tells the story of how she learned new ways to interact with the world around her. And it also gives readers some insight into the best ways to interact with people who, like Belle, rely on lip reading to communicate.
How does it feel to see people talking and to not actually hear them?
This is Zoe Rosen, a Richmond fourth grader. We put Zoe's question and questions from her classmates to El Defo's author, Cece Bell.
Well, the truth is, I have been deaf for a long time, for 40 years, and so I'm actually very much used to it. But I wear hearing aids, so most of the time when people speak, there is sound because I can hear them because of my hearing aids. But if you think about watching television without the volume and you look at the people and you see their mouths move, that's sort of what it looks like. And there's a little bit of what I like to call phantom voices. You get so used to hearing people that when you can't hear them, you can almost imagine yourself hearing them. It's a very strange sensation, but one that I'm very much used to. And it's really not that bad. It's just the way it is for me.
Belle was born able to hear, but she lost her hearing when she got meningitis as a four-year-old. This interested fourth grader Grace Williver.
Do you know how you got sick?
My dad is a doctor, and he kind of thinks that he might have had something on his hands, some germ or something that he simply passed on to me. I discourage him from thinking that because it makes him feel bad. That's one possibility, but the truth is people pick up germs everywhere all the time, and this was just one of those unfortunate coincidences for my parents. But who knows how I got sick.
When it comes time for Cece to start kindergarten, she goes to a school for deaf children. She has a teacher named Dorn who teaches her how to lip read. But when her family moves, Cece has to be in a classroom with students who can hear. Her mom tells her that she'll need to get a new hearing aid, too. Here's author Cece Belle reading from El Defo.
Summer ends. I find out that I will soon start first grade in a new school. Will I be in a class like Dorn's class? No, sweetie. They don't have a class like that in your new school. But you'll be going to school with your new neighborhood friends. You're getting a brand new, super powerful, just-for-school hearing aid that will help you hear better. Is it smaller than this one? Well, it's bigger. But you'll hear so much more, and you can wear the little one at home. The neighborhood kids, a bigger aid. Mom walks me to school on the first day. We've been here once before, and I already know where my classroom is, but I'm still scared. I wear my favorite striped shirt, and underneath that shirt, well hidden, I hope, is my brand new, super powerful, just-for-school hearing aid, the Phonic Ear. The phonic ear is enormous. It is heavy, and I am totally keeping it hidden.
The phonic ear that Cece wears is synced with a microphone the teacher wears like a necklace. Every day, Cece has to walk to the front of the class and give the teacher her microphone, and that makes her feel embarrassed. That led Richmond fourth grader Ronan Pichette to ask this question.
How does it feel when you walk in the door and everyone is staring at you because you're different?
I would imagine that everybody in the whole world has had this experience. Maybe you've come to school and your shirt's on inside out, or maybe you've got leaves in your hair and everybody looks at you. So I think we all know that it's a little bit on the embarrassing side. And for me, it made me always feel very, very hot and sweaty underneath my clothes. Not a good sensation. For me, it felt like every day the kids were looking at me, especially when I first moved to the Salem, Virginia area where I grew up. I was the new kid in this new school, and the kids just weren't used to me yet. So it got old real fast. But I think everybody knows what that feels like. It's not the best feeling in the world.
The phonic ear makes Cece stand out, but it also gives her the ability to do things her classmates can't. Like hear what the teacher is up to in the teacher's lounge, or even the bathroom. It's like having a superpower, and she secretly thinks up a superhero name for herself, El Defo.
A funny superpower that nobody knew.
This is fourth grader Ileana Foran. She says her favorite part of the book is
when she heard the teacher going to the bathroom. I thought that was pretty funny, because you don't usually hear your teachers going to the bathroom.
Fourth grader Abby Elder says she liked the part when Cece has a crush.
I liked when she liked that boy and she went over to his house.
Author Cece Belle says that's her favorite part as well.
My favorite part of the book was, especially when I was working on it, was all the stuff about my very first crush on a boy, Mike Miller. And I really enjoyed depicting myself as this preteen with all these hearts coming out of my head and following this boy around like he was the most beautiful creature on earth. So that was easily my favorite part. I laughed out loud sometimes just remembering the dumb things I did trying to impress this boy.
Richmond student Anna Hoff wants to know,
how did you come up with the idea to write a book about what happened to you?
I had been putting off this story for a long time, and I had been telling a lot of the stories that are featured in the book over the years, and I always got people laughing. I knew it was a good story. And then later, I happened to read Raina Telgemeier's book, Smile, which is a beloved graphic novel for kids. And once I saw that, I realized that the graphic novel format was perfect for my personal story. And I think I was just waiting for the right format to come along.
All the characters in El Defo are depicted as rabbits. Richmond fourth grader Miller Hintz is curious about that choice.
Why did you pick animals instead of humans in your book?
The reason for that is that rabbits have very, very big ears, and they can hear really well. And I was trying to create this visual metaphor of being the only rabbit in an entire school of rabbits whose giant ears were there and visible, but they did not work. They were broken. It was effective to have the ears really long and on top of my head because the cords that were connected to my hearing aid that went more to the sides of my head in real life to my ears. In the book, those cords go all the way up over my head and are very, very visible, which is closer to how I felt. I felt very conspicuous and like everyone was looking at me. So that kind of fit really well.
And there's another reason.
Also, bunnies are cute, and you can't go wrong with bunny rabbits.
Fourth grader Lucy Cabrera had this question for Belle.
Are all the characters in the book based on real people?
Absolutely. Sometimes I kept the characters' names, and sometimes I changed them. Basically, if I was unfair to one of the people in the story, their name got changed. And if I was nice to them, I kept their name. So that's sort of the code. You can tell who's who. But there's a few times where one character is actually sort of a composite of two different people because I didn't want to make the story too confusing. The more people I put in the mix, the harder it would be to understand. So everybody in the book is true. There's just a couple of characters who are sort of a mashup, but they represent real people.
Being different can be hard, and talking about it can take courage. Here's student Aaliyah Pratt.
How does it feel to share differences?
The one word answer to that question is scary. I was very, very scared to put this book out into the world. I just did not know what the reception would be, and I was also really worried about how other deaf people would experience it when they read it. Would they be offended? Would I possibly cross a line? Because every person and every person who feels different is different, and my experience of deafness is not the next person's experience of deafness.
While sharing one's differences can be hard, sometimes there are great rewards. And for author C.C. Bell, those rewards have also included high literary honors for El Defo, including a nomination for Vermont's Dorothy Canfield Fisher Award. For VPR News, I'm Amy Noyes.
The book is El Defo by C.C. Bell. Thanks to librarian Beth Redford at Richmond Elementary School. Next month on Dorothy's List, a mystery novel called The Art of Secrets. When Subba Khan's apartment burns in a mysterious fire, possibly a hate crime, her school rallies around her. Then a quirky piece of art donated to a school fundraiser for the Khans is revealed to be an unknown work by a famous artist, and it turns Subba's life upside down again. Here's an excerpt from The Art of Secrets.
We parked and got out of the car. Our eyes followed the direction of the fire hoses, first to our own building, then, incredulously, to where our own windows would be. But here, oddly opened, black-rimmed, bold dancing flames inside. No longer like windows, but like three smoky wood ovens in a row.
The blaze was contained to our unit, everything charred in a flash. The rest of the building was spared, except for the smoke and water damage. We had nothing left, nothing but our rusty old Ford. Even Solomon's books were from the library.
That was Richmond Elementary School fourth grader Lucy Cabrera reading from The Art of Secrets. It's next month's selection in our series, Dorothy's List, about the books nominated for Vermont's Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Book Award. Dorothy's List is sponsored by the VPR Journalism Fund. It's been a warm and relatively snow-free winter so far. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the weather's impact on tourism and other aspects of Vermont's economy. Send your thoughts and experiences to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Our producers are Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. Our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.